If Mel Brooks has a mantra, it might be, "Don't get me started," because once you do, you can't turn off. The spill of jokes, ideas, insights, Yiddishisms, and non sequiturs. His latest Broadway production, Young Frankenstein, from the 1974 movie of the same name, received 3 Tony Award nominations, and this week it won the Outer Critics Circle Award for Best Musical. The accolades were yet more proof that after more than 80 years of Young Frankenstein's Blazing Saddles, Springtime's for Hitler, and The Power of the Schwartz, Mel Brooks is still vibrant, still bubbles with surprise. We had a conversation with Mr. Brooks this week in our New York studios.
Do I have this right? When you were a kid, you used to do a version of Puttin' on the Ritz as sung by Frankenstein's Monster?
I used to do that as part of my act. And I would often do Puttin' on the Ritz as Boris Karloff, you know?
How did Boris Karloff do Puttin' on the Ritz?
Puttin' on the Ritz! He never finished the TZ.
Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes or cutaway coat, perfect fits.
Boris Karloff was part of my act. I used to do Boris Karloff as an English butler. On the pasta. You know, if I say to people today, you know, anybody under 73, you say, I'd like you to do an impression of Boris Karloff. They'd say, who? When we were doing Young Frankenstein, Gene said, you know, the monster doing Puttin' on the Ritz would be perfect. And I said, no, it would tear it. You can go over the top in a movie, but you must link yourselves to what it's all about. And if you don't, if you tear it, then it's just foolish and it's silly. And then you lose the storyline and the character. He said, let's do it. We can always edit it out. So I said, let's do it. It was the best thing in Young Frankenstein.
You must have read a lot of pop sociology about the relationship between Frankenstein and his creation and what that Mary Shelley story is about. And I wonder if any of it means anything to you.
I had my own private theory, and I know it's really nuts, but my own psychological theory was that Mary Shelley was talking about womb envy. Not penis envy.
I'm trying very hard to keep a straight face now, but you're serious.
I'm very serious because it's almost impossible for a guy to have a baby. I heard it happen once in Philadelphia, but I don't know if it's true. Yeah. But I think that she was onto something about men being unable to actually create life. Mm-hmm. And so the scientist figured out a way to reanimate dead tissue, literally create life. And I think she was on to womb envy, but I've been wrong before. I've been wrong about gum. I once thought gum was very good for you, and then somebody proved me wrong, and they said, no, it's very bad for you. So I may be proven wrong on womb envy.
But still, in over 80 years of life, to just be even potentially wrong on just gum and womb envy,
yes.
That's impressive.
Yes, those are the only two things I may have been wrong on.
I was astonished to discover, because I thought that musicals is something that you just started doing a few years ago. But you wrote a couple of musicals when you were in your 20s.
There were musicals like Shinbone Alley.
That's what I wanted.
You've never heard of that.
Not until I read all the material I could find.
Starring Eartha Kitt and Eddie Bracken. Yeah. When I was even younger, I wrote New Faces of 1952. I wrote a sketch in that, and that was a hit. And that ran for a couple of years.
So the musical is something that has interested you for some time.
Ever since I was a little kid, even when I was in the Army, I would do parodies. Mm-hmm. When we begin to clean the latrine, it brings back a smell. Anyway, so I would do stuff like that in the Army. And then I always wanted to write. And then when I got a job on the Sid Caesar show, I'd often try to stick a song in here and there. And then when I began making movies, when I did Blazing Saddles, I wrote 3 or 4. I wrote songs, one for Madeline Kahn, the late great Madeline Kahn, called I'm Tired.
That's a classic.
Yes, and
I'm exhausted.
Right, she was so funny.
I'm tired, sick and tired of love. I've had my fill of love from below and above. Tired of being admired.
So beautiful. So what a truly beautiful personality. And I loved writing music. And it was only when David Geffen kept pestering me to write The Producers as a musical. He was the first one to see it in his mind as a big musical comedy on Broadway. And so when it came time to do another musical, Tom Meehan suggested my movie, Young Frankenstein. And Tom wrote the book with me for The Producers, because when I was writing The Producer, I called him. He had done Annie on Broadway. He had a big hit. I said, Tom, why are they singing in the middle of this play? What, you know, what the hell are they doing? And he said, I'll tell you when they start singing. When they get so full of emotion that they can't talk anymore, that's when you start singing. When you make a movie, you wait 2 years for the first laugh.
Yeah.
You write it, and then you wait and you wait, and finally you have a rough cut screening somewhere in Pasadena, and you hear people laugh. You do a Broadway musical, and first day of rehearsal, people are laughing. Yeah. Nobody ever goes into show business to make money. Never. Because it's a very mercurial and precarious and stupid thing to do. But there is one real golden payoff, and that is applause, cheers, and more important than anything would be laughter.
We've just got a few minutes, and I have two questions to get to. Hope you don't mind.
Go, get to them.
At the end of Young Frankenstein, there's an open joke about a musical of Blazing Saddles. And I don't know if you're serious about doing a musical about Blazing Saddles.
I am, and I'm not, and I'm not, and I am, but I'm not. But I could. I could do it. I could do it tomorrow. But I don't think it's a good idea for the critics, because it's grist for their mill. But for the audience, it's a great idea, so I could do it. Or not. Or I could not do it.
How would you handle the campfire scene?
How about some more beans, Mr. Taggart?
I'd say you've had enough.
There's always been wind across the prairie. We know that. Since the beginning of time. Since cowboys scraped a tin plate of beans and drank gallons of black coffee. I would never leave that out. I mean, I'd be stoned if I left that scene out. I don't know what I would do about all the horses. There's 100,000 horses in Blazing Saddles. But there is a thing now called projection, and it's in almost every show on Broadway, so I could put the horses in projection. Maybe some critics will say, well, maybe there's something underneath all it. Maybe it's not just about farting. Maybe there are other things to consider. Anyway, I know I'm running off at the mouth, but, you know, look, I don't get a chance to be on NPR and talk to people who are smarter than me.
Well, that's not true.
Well, they all are. I've had a lot of dopes interview me, and you're one of the smartest dopes that has ever. No, I tell your wife she has very good taste.
Well, it's awfully nice talking to you. Thanks, Mr. Brooks.
Okay, Scott, keep in touch. Don't be strange.
How about a movie from a German guy who's been called the worst director in the world? NPR's Nihar Patel has more.
Uwe Boll's formative years sound pretty similar to Steven Spielberg's. An imaginative young boy inspired by the likes of Orson Welles and John Ford makes Super 8mm home movies. He gets rejected from a prestigious film school, but with a little money and a lot of moxie, produces his first film. But somewhere along the way, Uwe Boll's life story got a rewrite.
If I would be the worst director ever, why this is the case?
Well, you be the judge. His new movie is Postal. It's out tomorrow in a few cities. An unemployed American tries to stop a New Age cult, Al-Qaeda terrorists, and Nazis from getting their hands on a supply of deadly avian flu. Now, if you laughed at that last sentence, this movie is for you. Listen to this scene as two famous adversaries turn out to be close friends.
Hello, this is George W. Bush.
It's Osama. I need some help, man.
Hi there, Osama. I'm here for you, buddy.
Oh, thanks, Georgie. I just wish I knew how to quit you.
Postal is intended as satire, a high body count, un-PC, controversy-seeking one at that.
It's maybe too harsh for a lot of people. I felt like it's time for a wake-up call like this, to nail down that absurdity we're living in since September 11. It's kind of a dangerous world, and we don't know what's next.
Uwe adapted Postal from a video game. There are six such adaptations in Uwe's oeuvre. This is why he's the whipping boy for many online critics. Games make horrible movies. His films Alone in the Dark and House of the Dead are both on the Internet Movie Database's bottom 100 of all time. But with the built-in audience, video game adaptations do make money.
Internet geeks, no matter what I do, they're not even interested what it is. They trash me to the ground. And they think I have whatever, a money printing machine at home, you know, and this is stupid.
These, quote, geeks created websites like UweBullIsAntichrist.com or StopUweBull.org. There's also an online petition to get him to stop making movies with over 250,000 signatures. A couple of years ago, Uwe was fed up, and he challenged all his critics to a boxing match in Vancouver. From the opening bell, it was clear.
Round one, here we go.
That this was no PR stunt.
Fans, if you can see this, you can see, if you can get in close enough, you can see the determined look on Uwe Boll's face. He is not joking around, ladies and gentlemen. Throwing some seriously big shots. He looks like a man that hits pretty good.
Hundreds of people showed up to watch Uwe Boll, an amateur boxer, land vicious jabs and knock out four critics.
Eight. Nine. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. That fight is over.
Later, they turned it, of course, all against me and said, like, look, you promised us not to hit us, what was not true. I said that it will be a fight. But I trained for this because I was like, I thought, like, if I have to box four people in a row, who knows? Maybe they are taller, heavier, better. I don't know. So I have to prepare myself.
After that, Uwe took the fight back to the internet. In response to snarky reviews, he left his own R-rated postings in broken English.
Well, I just read the responses he had to his critics, and they made me laugh.
That's Dave Foley, one of the members of the comedy group Kids in the Hall, who stars in Postal.
And I thought, this guy sounds kind of interesting, and, you know, to me, he sounded like kind of this crazy German intellectual.
Foley was surprised that Uwe in person was polite, charming, easy to work with, and he wore the title of worst director like a shiny gold welterweight belt. Uwe even challenged fellow reviled director Michael Bay of Transformers and Armageddon fame to a boxing match. Bay dismissed Uwe as a troubled soul.
It shows he has no humor, you know, that he took it totally serious and was super pissed about what I said. I'm not a big Michael Bay fan.
A few of those critics Uwe boxed showed they could take a joke and made cameos in Postal, as does Uwe poking fun at himself as the owner of a Nazi-themed amusement park.
There are all that rumors out that my movies are financed with Nazi gold, and what should I say? It's true.
The art that he's creating isn't really about the movies anyway.
Dave Foley likens Uwe Boll's persona to comedian Andy Kaufman.
The art is really his life and his interaction with his critics. The movies are more or less incidental to that art.
Like Andy Kaufman, Uwe Boll has loyal fans, but it's hard to tell if they like his movies or just like him. He doesn't seem to care either way. At a recent screening for Postal, a woman told him about an annual party she throws.
They show all my movies and then, of course, the new ones, what came out in that year. And I said, good.
She called it her Super Boll Party. Nihar Patel, NPR News.
Bullwhip-wielding Indiana Jones, now a 60-something action hero, still cuts a wide swath at the multiplex. Indy had no trouble winning this weekend's box office brawl with Iron Man and Prince Caspian. Put together, their grosses wouldn't come up to his kneecap, but Dr. Jones has yet to set any new box office records. Estimates place the take for Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull at $126 million since Thursday. That makes it the second biggest May opening in history, after the latest Pirates of the Caribbean adventure. Still, with those numbers, there's no question that summer is here. And there are more than 100 pictures to open before Labor Day. We asked Bob Mondello to give us a selective hot weather preview.
Let's start with the big guys, the superheroes, back for one more digitally enhanced, special effects crammed roller coaster ride. Batman, for instance, in The Dark Knight, an adventure made even darker by the recent death of actor Heath Ledger, who plays Batman's nemesis, the Joker.
This city deserves a better class of criminal.
I'm gonna give it to him.
I've seen now what I have to become to stop men like him.
Let's put a smile on that face.
Batman and the Joker aren't the only ones who are returning. The Incredible Hulk will come back, played by Edward Norton. The Mummy will come back, tormenting Brendan Fraser. Brendan Fraser will come back in Journey to the Center of the Earth, which is itself coming back, this time in 3D. And amid all those comebacks is one first-timer, a troubled superhero named Hancock, who, along with his superpowers, has super problems.
Hancock's latest act of so-called heroics has once again enraged city officials.
I can smell that liquor on your breath.
Because I've been drinking.
Played by Will Smith, Hancock swears and womanizes and screws up so often that he finally gets public relations coaching on how to clean up his act.
Do I have permission to touch your body?
Yes!
It's not sexual.
Not that you're not an attractive woman. Maybe on a different day.
Get me out of here!
You don't have to have superpowers to save the world, but they help. Angelina Jolie gets all excited that James McAvoy can make bullets curve as they head towards targets in Wanted, though it's hard to see what that lets him do besides shoot around corners. There's also sorcery of the Jedi sort in Star Wars The Clone Wars, but this time it's animated.
Kidnapped, Jabba the Hutt's son has been. Negotiate the treaty with Jabba. Obi-Wan will. Find the renegades that hold Jabba's son. Your mission will be.
Repeat, I probably should. Animated, not live action, Clone Wars is. Ditto Kung Fu Panda, with Jack Black as a pudgy martial arts doofus saving a Chinese village. And what looks to be the cream of the animated crop is a little guy the Pixar folks have brought to life, a robot named Wall-E, who is left behind by humans and develops, over the course of some 700 years, a personality. Wall-E is perhaps the most unusual of the summer's comedians, but he has competition, including Adam Sandler as an assassin hairdresser in You Don't Mess with the Zohan, Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly as relatives who can't stand each other in Step Brothers, and in Ben Stiller's making of a war movie farce, Tropic Thunder, Robert Downey Jr. as a white actor hired to play a black character.
I'm a dude playing a dude disguised as another dude.
So, other boys gone wild will include the office dweeb Rainn Wilson seeking groupies and fame in The Rocker, and James Franco seeking the perfect high in Pineapple Express, a stoner comedy from the Apatow Factory.
How could he find us?
Heat-seeking missiles, bloodhounds, foxes, barracudas.
I'm kind of flabbergasted when you say things like that. It's weird.
Thank you. Not a compliment.
Boys Gone Wild are usually the whole summer comedy story, but this year they're joined by Girls Gone Wild in a bunch of feminized teen comedies, and also in Mamma Mia, a musical about a bride-to-be who has to consult her mother's diary when she's looking for a dad to walk her down the aisle.
And I have three possible fathers.
Oh, my God.
What does she do? To the music of ABBA and to her mother's great surprise, she invites all three.
There were three guys around the same time.
You shady lady.
The last time I saw your mother, she said she never wanted to see me again.
Meryl Streep plays Mom as a sort of sister in spirit to the womanly quartet of free spirits who will, in the words of the advertisements, get carried away in the movie version of Sex in the City.
After years of living in the city, I assumed that if my friends and I ever got our fairy tale endings, that would be the end of the story. But real life always has a twist.
The trailers hint that the twist might be that she leaves Big standing at the altar. And Sex in the City is barely the tip of the TV iceberg. There's also Get Smart, in which Steve Carell steps into Don Adams' shoe phones as Maxwell Smart.
How do I know you're not Control?
If I were Control, you'd already be dead.
If you were Control, you'd already be dead.
Neither of us is dead, so I'm obviously not from Control.
That actually makes sense.
We'll also see the return of two famous paranormalists in a new X-Files adventure.
Scully, I need you on this with me.
And that's what scares me.
It's here!
So you believe in these kind of things?
Let's just say I want to believe.
X-Files I Want to Believe does things traditionally, expanding a one-hour TV drama to a two-hour movie. Emma Thompson is heading a cast that's doing the opposite, squeezing an 11-hour miniseries into a two-hour movie.
Welcome to Bride's Head, Mr. Ryder.
It's the most beautiful house I've ever seen.
How kind you are.
Who's that in the car with your mother?
My sister.
I take it you're not one of us.
I don't live like this, if that's what you mean.
He's here as my friend. Don't you think you ought to know what he's getting into?
Bride's Head Revisited? Revisited. Evidence, you might say, that more sophisticated films, even ones with foreign accents, won't be completely squeezed out of the multiplex in hot weather. Among the more intriguing art house pictures, the Russian epic Mongol about the rise to power of Genghis Khan, the Spanish romance Elsa and Fred about a frisky couple falling in love in their 80s, a haunting British drama Boy A, a vaguely Borat-like mockumentary called The Doorman, and a couple of Sundance Festival hits, The Whackness about a high school drug dealer who pays his shrink Ben Kingsley with bags of marijuana, and a high school tale of Shakespeare, music, and a drama teacher who creates a classic sequel.
Hamlet 2? Doesn't everybody die at the end of the first one?
I have a device.
The time machine opens, revealing Hamlet and
Jesus!
The musical accompaniment to our play will be provided by the Gay Men's Chorus of Tucson.
Yes.
Just a steel town girl on a Saturday night.
Hamlet 2. Proof that summer can be a time for culture? I suppose we'll see. I'm Bob Mandela.
Filmmaker Fathi Akun is only 34 years old, and he's already been nominated for an Oscar. And his new movie, The Edge of Heaven, won the award for Best Screenplay at Cannes. It opens in the U.S. this week. Akun is from Germany. His parents immigrated there from Turkey in the 1960s. Turks are Germany's largest ethnic minority. In his films, he's always moving in and out of cultures, and his characters become tangled between them. And critics say Fathi Akun's new film may propel him into the top tier of filmmakers around the world. NPR's Neda Ulubi reports.
Fathi Akun's films are about Turks, Germans, punks, drunks, restless students, people uneasy in their worlds.
I want to go so far to say, like, filmmaking for me is like a sort of therapy, you know? But it helps me to answer certain questions I have on my mind.
The Edge of Heaven is part of Akun's ongoing inquiry into Europe's sometimes turbulent multiculturalism.
Sinsi Türkün.
Kann sein.
It's a film about generations, about relationship between mothers and daughters and fathers and sons.
And it's about Europe and the Middle East. One character is a professor, a German-born Turk who teaches Goethe to German students. Another is a political activist who flees Turkey. She falls in love with a young German whose mother disapproves. English is their common language.
And what exactly are you fighting for?
We are fighting for 100% human rights and 100% freedom of speech and 100% social education. In Turkey, just people with money can get education.
Maybe things will get better once you get into the European Union.
I don't trust the European Union.
Still, she's turning to Germany for asylum. Despite their tension, the Turks and Germans in The Edge of Heaven feed each other, shelter each other, and help each other in heartbreaking tragedy. Two women are horribly killed. To reveal much more might spoil The Edge of Heaven's Byzantine plot. This tale of Turks in Germany and Germans who find their way to Turkey is part of a global story about immigrants fitting in or not, says Denise Gutturk. She's a German professor at Berkeley.
People on the move who are speaking multiple languages, who are sort of easily moving across borders between different spaces.
That's true of Fathi Akun's entire body of work, which ranges so far from a music documentary to a sweet romantic road comedy to his breakthrough film, Head On, from 3 years ago. That rough love story about two young Turks in Hamburg won a prestigious European film award called the Golden Bear.
It was the first Golden Bear Award for a German film in 18 years.
Berkeley professor Denise Gutturk.
Nonetheless, there were also questions about whether this is really a German film. You know, are we talking about German cinema, Turkish cinema, European cinema, world cinema?
Fathi Akun was surprised to find himself embraced in Turkey as a Turkish filmmaker.
It's okay with me because I love my parents and I have the country of my parents and my parents want to consider me as Turkish. I don't have a problem with that, you know. So I'm both.
But Akun says he's a child of Hollywood, too. His biggest inspiration, he says, might be Martin Scorsese.
I come from this Muslim background. My parents are very faithful people, you know, and I respect that. And when I saw the early work of Scorsese, like Who's That Knocking at My Door or Mean Streets, you know, I was very, like, so happy to see these films and to see the struggling of the characters with their own religion, you know.
Okay, I just come out of confession, right? And the priest gives me the usual penance, right? 10 Hail Marys, 10 Our Fathers, 10 whatever. Those things, they don't mean anything to me. They're just words. Now, that may be okay for the others, but it just doesn't work for me.
I am going through the struggling, you know, with my own background.
Akun's bicultural background confers a kind of authority when it comes to telling stories about a world filled with people who come from someplace else. But Akun doesn't want to be anyone's spokesman.
I never had the feeling like I want to be a messenger, or I want to be like the guy who is, you know, crossing the bridges and link the two worlds to another. No. I just want to do good films, whatever that means.
Fatih Akun just finished shooting his first film in the United States. It's a short about an immigrant, someplace where the borders melt in front of you. New York's Chinatown. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And you can watch clips from The Edge of Heaven and read a review by our critic, Bob Mondello. That's at npr.org/movies.
We're remembering the life and work of filmmaker Sidney Pollack. He died of cancer at his home in Los Angeles. He was 73 years old. Pollack was best known for directing The Way We Were, Out of Africa, Tootsie, and 3 Days of the Condor. He was also a producer and an actor. Pollack appeared in Woody Allen's Manhattan and Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. Howie Mofshevitz of Colorado Public Radio has this appreciation.
Sidney Pollack began his career as an actor. But in 1961, he found himself on the set of The Young Savages as a dialogue coach. His work attracted the attention of the film's veteran star, Burt Lancaster. In a 1990 interview with WHYY's Fresh Air, Pollack remembered being called into Lancaster's office.
He said, you know, you ought to be a director. You really should. What do you want to be told what to do when you can be telling everybody what to do for? That was the way he put it. And he picked up the phone and he called Lou Wasserman and said, Lou, I got a kid here. I don't know if he can direct, but I think he's talented. I want you to talk to him. And I'm quoting verbatim now. And he said, in any case, he can't be worse than those bums you got working for you now.
Wasserman, the head of Universal Pictures, put Pollack under the wing of a producer. And before long, Pollack was directing TV. He made his first feature film, The Slender Thread, in 1965. Film historian Patricia Aaron says he followed it with 20 more that ran the gamut of genres.
To me, he is one of the last of the great studio directors that could do just about anything, and he did. He made westerns early on, action thrillers, melodramas, love stories. He's not a great auteur that had a unique vision or visual style, so you don't come away thinking about him as a director. You come away thinking about the film.
Aarons adds that Pollack did more than repeat the conventional Hollywood forms. He gave them heft by giving them a twist.
The Way We Were is not just a great, sad love story, but it's about the Hollywood 10 and blacklisting.
This isn't college. This is grown-up politics, Katie. And it's stupid and dangerous.
What are you telling me to do, sit by and shut up just because it's dangerous?
I'm telling you it's a waste. That's what I'm telling you. And that those men and their families are only going to get hurt. And that nothing is going to change. Nothing. And after jail, after 5 or 6 years of bad blood, when it's practical for some fascist producer to hire some communist writer to save his ass because his hit movie's in trouble, he'll do it. They'll both do it. They'll make movies. They'll have dinner, they'll play tennis, they'll make passes at each other's wives. Now, what in the hell did anybody ever go to jail for?
So there's a background of politics that's in the film, same in Out of Africa, about colonialists, or even an early film like Jeremiah Johnson, which gave us a new image of the West. So he has a way of taking traditional Hollywood genres and bringing more out of them.
He would never do a film, a political film, directly. He didn't like pamphlets. He liked the metaphor.
Michael Henry Wilson, a French-born filmmaker and friend of Pollack's, planned to shoot a documentary about Pollack before the director fell ill. Wilson says that Pollack returned to several themes over and over throughout his career.
There's a line that you hear in practically all of Sidney's films, is, I'm going home. And so many of his films are about finding yourself, finding your roots, finding your home. And the journey is really what a lot of these films are about.
Which way are you headed, Jeremiah?
Canada, maybe. I hear there's land there a man has never seen.
There's one line that also I want to mention, because practically every other film of Sidney has it. You think not getting caught in a lie is the same thing as telling the truth. It's a good line. You think not getting caught in the lie is the same thing as telling the truth.
In combining issues with entertainment, Sidney Pollack drew on his first job in films, says historian Patricia Ahrens.
His huge contribution is his ability to bring out the very best performance from his actors.
Ahrens says a lot of that had to do with Pollack's own experience as an actor. He continued to take small parts throughout his career, sometimes reluctantly, as he told NPR in 1993, when talking about playing the agent for Dustin Hoffman's cross-dressing character in Tootsie.
I had a very good actor all set to play that part, and he kept saying, I want you to play that part. And I kept saying, Dustin, you're crazy. I got enough to do. I haven't acted in years, and I don't want to do it. And finally he started sending me flowers, dozens of roses, saying, please be my agent, love, Dorothy. And I really ended up doing it basically to mollify him.
Nobody will hire you.
Are you saying that nobody in New York will work with me?
Oh, no, that's too limiting. Nobody in Hollywood wants to work with you either. I can't even send you up for a commercial. You play the tomato for 30 seconds. They want a half a day over schedule because you wouldn't sit down.
Yes, it wasn't logical.
You were a tomato! A tomato doesn't have logic!
Sidney Pollack in person was the antithesis of Tootsie's brusque agent, says Pollack's friend Michael Henry Wilson.
Sidney was probably the nicest person you could meet in that business. A true straight shooter, also someone who nurtured doubts about what he was doing, was never satisfied with what he was doing, and was incredibly nervous each time a new film opened, and could not believe that some of his films were so successful. He was so humble and honest.
Sidney Pollack was directing the HBO dramatic film Recount about the 2000 election before illness forced him to abandon the project. For NPR News, I'm Howie Mofsovitz.